Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on the eve of qualifying weekend for the 101st Indianapolis 500. I'm Kevin Lee. Donald Davidson is here to address your questions of a historical nature about this great race or the world's greatest race course. And at the moment, there are open phone lines. Often that's because people are listening on the stream, which is a minute or two behind. So it will be a minute or two from now when they hear we have open phone lines. So
okay. They'll
start piling in just a moment at 317-239-1070 is our number. Our email-only shows are coming up next week on Tuesday and Thursday night. Your email questions, no Twitter questions, must be submitted by noon on Monday. So noon on Monday is our cutoff date. And again, the cars are going to be kind enough to gather for us to provide some background as we get going and produce those shows for you for next week. Donald, busy day today, and now we get set for qualifying coming up tomorrow. What do you do on qualifying days if you're not on the network? Are you on the network the entire time?
Yes.
How do you track things? We see you remember these things throughout the years. Do you try to make this ingrained in your mind as it happens, or at the end of the month you go back and start looking at
things?
You
know what? I'll tell you what. First of all, observation of a good friend of ours, Dave Scoggin, rings true once again. And one time, several years ago, he was really down when the weather was bad. And he said, I don't know what it is about this place. When the weather's bad, no matter how much time is lost, it's always nice for the draw. How come the sun comes out for the draw? And it happened again. But anyway, in answer to your question, it was a bit of a dilemma for me because for decades, I would keep detailed records of the qualifications. Mm-hmm. And I will probably still do that, but not quite with the same conviction, because it used to be that every qualifying lap that was turned was carved in stone.
Yeah.
Even if it was a wave off.
Yep.
Or even if somebody went out and didn't take the flag, but once they took the flag, you write down all the speeds. Now they get wiped out. And you know, I understand the situation, but for me personally, I don't memorize the stuff as much as I did, because during the course of the weekend, many of the qualifying runs that you record are going to end up being wiped out. So I don't know if anybody, I think some other people struggled with that a little bit, but that's just, you know, the time has moved on.
No,
things are done differently
now.
We
miss that simplicity of the record keeping. I think most of us do, and obviously someone in your position is going to have thoughts on that. You know what, this new format is, in some ways, when you talk about all the different lap times that are out there and a lap and a qualifying run isn't the qualifying run of record, you know, it's a little bit like European-style qualifying or like qualifying sessions on road circuits. You know, for example, if it's a 30-minute session and you're just recording your best lap, and that's your best lap of note for the record.
Well, so far, I mean, the way that it's played out, it's been very entertaining.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it. It's just that it's not the way that it was. And to me, every single qualifying attempt was an event. And when you would hear Tom Carnegie say, and we have some activity down at the starting finish line, or John Totten, whoever.
Yep.
And if somebody presented themselves at the line, went out, did a couple of warm-ups, came in, never took the green, even so, that was an event. It was just like every single car that went out was an event unto its own. And now it's different.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, we have full phone lines, so let's get into it. And we start with Mike in Pittsboro. Hi, Mike. You're on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan with Donald.
Hello. Hey, Donald, real quick, I'd like to ask two things. Talk about the Mormon Wasp and the rarity of that car. And then talk a little bit about Johnny Parsons. And I'll hang up and listen to your answers.
Well, before you hang up, which Johnny Parsons do you want, father or son?
JP Jr. Johnny Parsons Jr.
All right, very good. Well, first of all, it's not the Mormon Wasp, it's the Mormon Wasp. There was the Mormon Meteor, which was something completely different. That was Ab Jenkins' land speed record cars. The Mormon Wasp I don't know exactly, since I guess he's hung up now, I don't know exactly what he's after, except that it was a purpose-built competition car. The intent from the very beginning, or in the very beginning, was that it would be stripped-down passenger cars so that the people would watch the races and see being raced virtually what you could go and buy. But there was no rule that said that that's what it had to be. That was the intent. And so the Marmon engineers built this single-seater. Now, some references have that it was built for the 1911 500 specifically. That's not true. The car was built during the winter of 1909-1910 and actually made its debut to be tested, I think, in March of 1910, which is months before they even knew there was going to be a 500-mile race. So it had raced, and the body was a different configuration, so that was redone for the 1911 race. But I could talk at length about the Marmon, in spite of not being a gearhead, so I'm not sure what the caller...
I think people always like to hear about that car.
Well, it was a single seater and with a streamlined body, redone for 1911, and it had run in a number of shorter races, and then when the 500 was announced for 1911 in late September of 1910 is when they said, let's do this next year, and so they thought, well, let's run this, and so. There was no rule that said that you had to carry a riding mechanic. It's just that everybody did. And so the thinking was, well, look, this car is streamlined. We can save the weight of the second person and so on and so forth. So Ray Haroon is out practicing with the thing, and they get the complaints from other teams that hadn't seen this because it had run in 1910, as they say. But usually in shorter events and with not nearly as large a field as they had for the 1911 500. So there's a lot of teams that hadn't seen this thing before, and so they came in and suggested that Ray Haroon might be a safety hazard because he's out there by himself without a riding mechanic to appraise him that somebody's coming up one side or the other. And so he then remembers something that he's seen several years ago in Chicago, and boy, this is the history lesson here. He said that he was a chauffeur for William Thorne, who was the president of Montgomery Ward, and this is in 1904. And when I used to go see Ray Haroon, and he told me, and he did as a little aside and a chuckle. He said, when I got that job, I didn't know how to drive. But I thought it was pretty simple to learn, and it was tiller-steering, and the cars didn't go very far. So I thought, well, this shouldn't be too hard to figure out. So anyway, so he said, I'm sitting outside the building. Mr. Thorne's inside taking a meeting, and there's all this commotion going on the street and bicycles and horse-drawn vehicles, and there's no traffic pattern, apparently. And he said, along comes a horse-drawn taxi, and a two-wheel thing. The fellow's sitting up on the top of the thing with a cloak and a top hat and a whip. And he said, as it went by, I noticed that he had a pole sticking out with a mirror. And he would look into it every now and again to make sure that he wasn't not going to knock somebody off their bicycle or something. And so he thought, boy, that's a good idea. I'll have to remember that. So when the questions were raised during practice in 1911, and the officials just came down and said to the Marmon engineers, the team, and said, look, we're getting some complaints from some of the other teams. Have you got a solution? So Ray Haroon said, I remember that fellow with the mirror on the horse-drawn taxi. So he went downtown, bought a mirror that was 3 by 8 inches. And mounted it in a little casing, which is streamlined. If you look at that casing, it's wedge-shaped, so it produces downforce, and I think that was probably deliberate, and mounted on rods above the cowling. And so he could drive along and look straight ahead, but he would look up and then presumably have the fine panoramic view of what was going on behind him. And so I asked him, I said, so it worked out pretty well. And he leaned forward again and he said, well, to tell you the truth, it shook so bad on the bricks and water, I couldn't see a damn thing in it. But nobody knew that but me. So anyway, they won the race. Cyrus Patsky was a relief driver. Ray Haroon said, you know, that 500 miles is too long to go. First of all, he said, I told the Marmon brothers, look, I quit at the end of the 1910 season. And he said, I never thought of myself as a race driver. He said, I was an engineer and I like to, we like to try things out. I thought the best way for me to was to drive the things myself. And he said, so a lot of the times when I was in a race, I'm taking note and looking around and seeing if what we thought might work was working. But he said at the end of the 1910 season, I'd had enough. Mm-hmm. And so they said, well, the Marmon brothers said, we want you to drive in this race. And he said, no, I quit. And it's 500 miles. And he said, I drove in the 200 last year, and that was enough for me. And I don't want to do it anymore. And in fact, he told me, he said, I said to them, Joe Dawson, and I thought this was real endorsement, because Joe Dawson was only 21. Yes, he was 21 at that time. And he said, I told them Joe Dawson was perfectly capable of driving the car. And they said, well, we're going to put him in the more conventional stripped-down passenger car, but we want you in there. So anyway, he took Cyrus Patsky as a relief driver. Patsky was in it for about 35 laps, which doesn't sound like much, but it was about an hour at the wheel. And all of the team members, all of the reports afterwards, they're very, very complimentary of Cyrus Patsky's role, even although he's sort of forgotten in history. Ray Haroon returned to the wheel and then won the race at an average speed of 74.602 miles an hour.
We'll have to speak on JP in just a moment.
We'll have to do that when we come back.
Okay, yeah. And then more phone calls as well with Donald Davidson on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Talk of Gasoline Alley continues from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I'm Kevin Lee with Donald Davidson. Back to the phones in a moment, but let's finish up a part two. And I can tell you've got more to talk about the Marmon Wasp, or are you to move on to JP?
I'll move on to JP, okay. And I'm really not going to be able to do him justice because we probably should move these along a little quicker than we have been. But Johnny was a footnote in history because his father, Johnny Parsons, who won the – and it's not a senior and junior because they've got different – well, not technically. They had different middle names. But we'll call him – well, actually, they were both JP, so that makes it confusing. Anyway, the 1950 winner, Johnny Parsons, was the first Indianapolis 500 winner to watch his own son qualify, which JP did in 1974. He spent his early years in Speedway and was – his – the parents divorced. Johnny Parsons was married to a lady senior, although I said there was no senior and junior. But anyway, the elder Parsons was married to a lady named Arza, and they divorced. And then Arza married Dwayne Carter, fellow driver. And Johnny and his sister, Joni, were raised by Dwayne Carter and Arza, who was their mother. And then along came Dwayne Carter Jr., who we know as Poncho, and then there was Dana, and they were all raised in the same household. So the irony is that when Johnny, the son, drove in his first 500, that was also the same year that Poncho drove in the 500. So Arza had two sons, and so, you know, for all of the family members and Joni, the sister, it was really something that both of the boys who'd raced, you know, been little kids and running quarter midgets out at Westlake and all that kind of stuff were now in the Indianapolis 500 together.
What's their difference in ages?
Johnny is 6 years older than Poncho.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, Johnny's first. The first time he was entered for the 500 was 1969 in one of my favorite car names, Speedy's Roasted Chicken Special. But he was turned down because he had come back and run USAC sprints a little bit and had been running on the West Coast in midgets. But the officials felt, and in those days they were fairly selective about whether you got to take a rookie test or not. It wasn't a case of proving. You know, they would actually screen you and your performance up to that point in the coming up through the ranks days determined whether they would even allow you to take a test. And they took him to one side and said, you know, listen, kid, you need to, you know, get out and run another couple of, you know, run some more races and then come back. So it was 1973 before he came in and passed the test, and he didn't make it that year. And he was involved in a couple of interesting scenarios as part of the AJ Foyt team, but I don't have time to get into that now. It's a little complicated, but an entertaining story for a few of us. So 1974 was the first year that he qualified for the race, and his best finishes, and we are jumping around here and jumping ahead, the best finishes were in 1977 and 1985 when he finished fifth in both of those, and he was also 10th in 78, and gained a reputation for sometimes jumping into a car when a team it wasn't working out with the original driver, and so he was known as somebody that could get in and with very few laps get it up to speed. I think he's finally quit, but it wasn't until, not that long ago. He was still running, you know, the Hoosier 100 at the dirt at the fairgrounds and so forth. And he was a very good dirt track driver, short track driver. Won in 1977, they had a bunch of USAC midget races, which they would run on Wednesday nights. And Johnny had a little tiny, I suppose you'd call it a road-type design. It sat a lot lower than most of the conventional upright midgets. And they would, they would have semi-inverted starts, and it wouldn't be long before he would get up to the front. So based on a lot of those Raceway Park events, he ended up second in national midget point standing. So, again, I'm not doing him justice. He probably, in championship racing, probably had more fortune on dirt than pavement, but he did have these two spectacular fifths in 77 and 85 at the Indianapolis Speedway. And, I spent a lot of time with the Parsons family, and so there's a lot of little JP anecdotes, but we probably ought to move on now to other callers.
I didn't know there was a quarter midget track at Westlake.
Oh, yes.
That's I raced dirt bikes there for a little while. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, that might have been at the same place 10 years later, and I went to grade school at Westlake.
Well, it's before 465 went in, and I think it was just across the way from where the apartments are, and then the Westlake Drive-In Theater. I think it was on the other side of what is now the 465, I know there was a. There was a root beer stand there, and a lot of people ran out there. In fact, maybe we could find out specifically where that was, but it was just known as Westlake.
Okay. All right, let's sneak in a call in this segment, and Kyle has been waiting patiently. Hi, Kyle. You're on with Donald.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Good, Paul.
Great.
Good, Kyle.
Good. I want to know if you could tell me about Babe Stapp.
Yes, sure. Babe Stapp was a... Babe obviously was a nickname. He didn't like his first name, which was Egbert. And his tenure at the Speedway was 1927 through 1940 was his last start. And he led a lot of the 1933 race for Mike Boyle. And that was probably his best run, although he didn't finish. But he was sixth in 28 and then was fifth in 1939. The highest finish was fifth with an Alfa Romeo owned by Bill White. And he was the 1935 Midwest champion, which... was what we now call sprint cars, but they weren't called sprint cars at that time. They called them big cars. But let's see. In 1927, he was an early out driving a Duesenberg, and he took over for another driver named Benny Schoaf. And there were a lot of heartbreakers at the Indianapolis Speedway, and this was one. The pair of them alternated at the wheel, and they were running second when the car broke down with two laps to go. And under the current rules, they probably still would have ended up second because everybody would get spread out so far. And when the winner comes across the line and then, you know, everybody completes that lap and the race is over. But back then, they were still trying to get as many cars as was reasonable, 10 at least, to complete the full 500 miles. And so they as the car after car came in to complete the 199th and 200 laps, they eventually slipped down to 13th place. His son, Steve Stapp, was a driver and then became a very proficient car builder, dirt cars and sprint cars and so forth. And although Babe was born in Texas, born in San Antonio, but was a West Coaster for all the time that he drove, and he was one of the standout drivers at the famed Legion Ascot Speedway, which closed in January 1936. And in later years, Babe and his wife moved back to, they came to Brownsburg because Steve was back here, and they ran a car wash for a while. But he was a very nice man and just a great link with the past. And I wish that I'd spent more time with him to ask about some of the lesser known people that he ran against on the West Coast.
Kyle, thank you for the question. More for Donald coming up on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Before we continue in the phone lines, Donald has a follow-up.
Yeah, in trying to, instead of going year by year and year by year and just to throw out some highlights, I forget a couple of things. And so during the commercial breaks, when I mentioned that Babe Stapp's best finish in the 500 was fifth in 1939, which it was, he also was fourth as a relief driver for Deacon Litz in 1934 with the Stokely Food Product Special. And then in 35, he was relieved Deacon Litz again, and there was another driver named Johnny Sawyer who became a second relief driver, and they finished eighth. And then 1936, with the Perung Special, he had qualified in the middle of the front row. So I probably should have thrown that one in.
All right, thank you. And we get now to Noah, who's next in Indianapolis with Donald Davidson. Hi, Noah.
Yeah, Donald, remember back, back in the early 80s, I was at qualifying one day, and I believe it was 81, and I saw a rhubarb-type fight start between A.J. Foyt and Robin Miller, and I remember Robin Miller. Can you tell me anything about that, about cheating or whatever, please? Thank you.
It was, I think that was 81. The radar guns were fairly new at that time. And Robin suggested, and I don't know that I had this exactly right, but I know that
You're on it.
Foyt did not like the fact that people were coming out with radar guns and pointing them down the track to get, I don't know what terminal velocity, is that the term, I think? In other words, get the, how fast are they coming down the straightaway?
Yeah.
And so Foyt didn't want anybody timing any of his cars just in case it may come up that they might be running a little faster than some of the others for no apparent reason. So,
and not
anyway,
finishing the lap fully to give time.
That was known as sandbagging.
Yep.
Never show a complete lap. In fact, to go off a little bit, I think that was the same year when they were fairly new, and Foyt did not like the fact that they were being pointed down the straightaway. So among my favorite Foyt stories is that Penske, being Penske and always being a step ahead of everybody else, Foyt's out there practicing, and then he noticed that there's a Penske guy over on the backstretch was about half, I think, out of turn two and part of the way, maybe halfway down the backstretch. I don't know. Anyway, there's one single guy out there with a radar gun in Penske uniform. So Foyt finished the lap and came in, gets out of the car, gets on the golf cart, takes off, goes back to the garage area, old garage area still, goes inside, comes out on a motorcycle, and then rides over to turn two, or just, onto the backstretch, has a discussion with the Penske crew member, and made a couple of suggestions and so on and so forth, but we're on radio here. This is not like giving a talk, so... anyway, the discussion completed. He gets back on the motorcycle, rides it back, gets into the garage area, goes golf cart and then back out to the track, and then went out to practice, and the Penske guy wasn't out there anymore. Anyway, so I think Robin made a couple of comments about how fast Foyt's cars were coming down the straightaway. Foyt didn't like that, and Robin was standing over by the scoring pylon, which is not the one that's there now, but and then I think Foyt actually grabbed him by the hair or the back of the neck and just scuffed him up a little bit.
Yeah, something like that.
And Robin took it in the I don't know if you'd call it the spirit of the day.
I don't even think it offended him.
I don't think so. In fact, it was probably almost like a badge of honor. And so it wasn't too long before everything seemed to be fine with them, and then they seemed to become very good friends. In fact, I remember one year I got a Christmas card, and it was Robin and Foyt wearing Santa Claus hats was the Christmas card. So
I think there were originally some lawyers involved at one point.
Well, were there? I don't remember. I know that...
at least a thread of it, because it was something that was published in the Star, and I know Foyt was not happy with the allegations of cheating.
Oh, he may have, but Robin didn't.
Yeah. And I'm not sure it ever actually got to that. I've heard Robin tell the story a few times, and it's a fun story. I hadn't heard the part, though, about AJ going out to the backstretch, though. That's good.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there was, never mind.
Yeah, okay. Hey, thanks for the question. That's good. 317-239-1070. You know what? We probably have enough to fill us up for the rest of the night. You can call in, but chances aren't incredibly strong of getting on. But you never know. Brian in Atlanta is next. Hi, Brian.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my question. Hey, Donald, in the early days, I know most all the races were all on dirt, except for Indy. When did they start running pavement tracks?
Well, to go back to the very beginning, the early championship races were mostly on road courses. And then you got to the point where then the board tracks came in. And,
yeah, I know about the board tracks, but more about the asphalt. I know.
Yes.
I think Milwaukee and Trenton.
Okay.
I didn't know if there was anything before that.
Yes, that was later. I've got to stop and think what would be the first asphalt track, but I think probably Darlington, because I don't think there was anything early. No, they ran there in 1950.
No, but, I'm just surprised it was that late. Yeah.
Well. I'm just thinking because this is for myself. Other than obviously the Indianapolis Speedway, which is bricks and mortar, and then eventually a mixture of asphalt and then completely asphalt. You went through the board track era or dirt, and then after when you got into the early 30s and the Depression, then everything was on dirt, and so all of the races were dirt, and I'd say the first one that was not was Darlington, South Carolina, 50. In fact, the fellow Harold Bracington that built that track, actually, he loved the Indianapolis 500 and wanted to try and have a track in the South that would run it. I don't think he originally intended it to be for stock cars. And so, but actually the first race there was a 500-mile race, NASCAR, Labor Day, 1950. And then was it like December the 1st or 2nd, was the final national championship race of the 1950 season, and it was at Darlington.
Wow.
And it was won by Johnny Parsons, senior. Even though I said there was no senior and junior, but I'll just to do that to distinguish one from the other. They ran four races at Darlington. They ran, I think it was July the 4th in 51, and then they also ran in 54 and 56. And then as far as the other tracks, Milwaukee was paved in 1954.
Okay.
And so there's some little trivia there about, in fact, the last person to win a championship race on dirt and the first person to win a championship race on pavement was the same guy, Chuck Stevenson. And a lot of trivia, but really, you know, a lot of stuff on the 50s. But to move on here, so Milwaukee became paved in 54, and then Trenton, which had run a championship in 1949, just the one. They ran sprints. There was one championship race, 49 when it was dirt. That was paved in 57. And then, let's see, then you started to get, you come into the 60s, and then Langhorne was paved in 1965. I don't know if I'm missing any in the meantime. And then when you get to like 68, Michigan Speedway is built. And then you went into this period where a bunch of new tracks were built. So Michigan opened in 1968, Ontario in 70, Pocono in 71, and then various other places that were proposed and never built. And, you know, there was going to be all these super speedways. Some were built. And so I don't know if that kind of answers the question or not.
I think it does.
So I would say Darlington was the first as a purpose-built track. Oh, Raleigh, North Carolina in 1952 had one race. And then that was probably it until Milwaukee was paved in 54, then Trenton, and on and on and on.
Okay, thank you for the question. More with Donald coming up from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson, and Dan in Greencastle is up next. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. Yes, interested in Dutch Bauman.
Oh.
I heard quite a bit on him, and I've become acquainted with his grandfather. His brother's grandson lives out in the Fillmore area or somewhere out in there, and become acquainted with him. I want to see what I can find out on him.
Okay, Charles Albin Bauman, two N's, that's misspelled a lot, and went by the nickname of Dutch. And he was at Indianapolis just 2 years. He was a dirt track driver and came up through the ranks and ran a lot with Wilbur Shaw when he was coming up, Louis Schneider, Howdy Wilcox II, Bill Cummings. And whilst they went to the Indianapolis Speedway early, he was at the Speedway in 1927 and 28 only. And in 1927, he just had the one start, but he drove in the race twice. It's in 27. He dropped out and then took over for Louis Schneider, and then who was a very good friend of his, and then dropped out of that one as well with Miller Specials. In 1928, he came back and qualified for the Duesenbergs. And I think I don't know if we talked about this yesterday, I think. In 1928, there were 32 cars qualified.
Yep.
And three of them crashed before the race, including two on race morning. And two of the Duesenbergs, Laura Korb, they had a warm-up session of some kind on race morning, and I think it was damp. And Laura Korb and Dutch Bauman both had accidents, and their cars had to be withdrawn. But Dutch Bauman did drive in the race, and but for coming down into the late stages, it looked like he may be the co-driver on the winning car, because he relieved Tony Galata with the car that had actually been entered by Frank Lockhart and ran as the Stutz Black Hawk Special. Although there was nothing Stutz about it, it was a Miller and had belonged to Frank Lockhart, who was entered in this car, and then was fatally injured trying to break the world land speed record at Daytona Beach on April the 25th. But the car retained the name of the Stutz Blackhawk Special. Tony Galata was relieved, handed over to Dutch Bauman. Bowman ran it for a while, handed it back to Galata, and then they had some problems late in the race, made a lengthy stop, and then actually ended up finishing in 10th place. But with about 20 laps to go, it looked like this was going to be the winning car. And Dutch, because he had to, in running AAA, he was restricted from running a lot of the races that he would normally run. And he thought, I don't want to run the big races and run this risk. I'd rather be going out and running every week at the little dirt tracks around the state, and I can make a better living at that. And so he ended up, had an accident at Kankakee, Illinois. And it was rather strange because I know that it was 1930, and he had the accident. And then I think he passed away a couple of days later, and he actually hit a wooden picket fence. And I think that he got part of the fence in the chest, didn't help any. But I did know some people that or at least one man, the late Bob Stroud told me, he said, I went to see him in hospital. Hmm. And he seemed to be okay. And then he passed away a couple of days later. And then one of the thinking was, I don't know what, you know, if there was any autopsy or things were just, in those days were not handled the way that they are now. I remember Bob Stroud suggesting that it could be that the wooden picket fence was painted, and that maybe some lead in the paint may have got in his system and caused some poison. I don't know, and that's been a long time since I heard that. But anyway, Dutch Bowman died in 1930, and lived in a little house on just off of East 10th, which I've been by to see. I think it was Bradley or something like that. Anyway, there was a business that was like a tire repair shop for a while, and haven't been over there for a while, so I'm not describing this very well, and probably the people that live there now wouldn't appreciate if you drove by there anyway. The house in which he lived was still there. He had a son who I think is still around, living up in Carmel, that I spend a little bit of time with, and then other family members. In fact, there's a tie-in with the orchard, Adrian's Orchard on Epler. There's a connection there with that family and Dutch Bowman's family.
All right. Thank you for the question. Very good question, Dan. And Jay in St. Paul is next. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Jay.
Hi, guys. Wanted to ask a couple of qualifying questions. One was back in the 10-lap era.
Yes.
Did you ever note a most consistent of
no.
10-lap qualifiers?
Okay. No, I never even thought about that. Nope, never did that.
And then how about qualifying attendance? I know that in a lot of years, the qualifying attendance would kind of rival a race day attendance.
Mm-hmm.
Was that going all the way back to the beginning, or was that
no.
a gradual thing that people started getting into more?
No, I think that was something that picked up in the 1950s, and my first year was 1964, and I remember them saying, I had several people say, look at the crowd here for the first day of qualification. They said, this is comparable with last year's race. And the crowds built and built in the 1950s and 60s, and I think if you want the one ingredient that I think that was more responsible for that than anything else, and that was the voice of Tom Carnegie.
Yeah.
And I think if you know, the drivers were out there breaking the track record, but it was Tom Carnegie's description and his handling of all that thing. I think that you can lay all of the success of the building of the crowds of qualification right at the feet of Tom Carnegie.
And he's on it.
Right on cue.
Where'd you get that from?
Right on cue. Well, that was my impersonation. It's pretty good.
Golly, I was
it?
Looking at you, and your mouth wasn't moving. You also do ventriloquism.
And, and the 500 race day was a very tough ticket at the time, right?
The what now?
The race was a tough ticket.
Yes.
It was
oh, yes.
sold out. So,
yes.
As you say, some might say, well, how could it rival race day? Well, that was an opportunity for people to come who didn't have a chance to come on race day.
Well, I remember actually, you know, several different things. On the corner of what used to be 16th and Georgetown, I remember that, and I don't know what the years would be, but I know that, you know, the day before the race, you'd see the line of people out there still trying to buy tickets because there would be tickets available. And then they would put out the sign, you know, sold out. And then I noticed that it was starting to get, you know, earlier and earlier, like 3 days before, four, five, the first weekend of qualifying. And then sometimes the track was opening and they were already sold out. And there was an opportunity to come and qualifications. Then there were other people that preferred qualifications. And then another thing, too, when it was the full month and the 2 weekends of qualifying, the pole day was 2 weeks before the race. And so there would be people that would come in from, they'd fly in from California to go to pole day and then fly home and then come back for the race.
Yeah. And it made more sense to do that than do it in consecutive weekends. That seems to be a lot of going back and forth. So very interesting. Thank you for the question tonight, Jay. Donald, thank you. And a reminder to people, tomorrow night,
yes,
you're on at 7 o'clock. So we're kind of breaking things up. We have coverage all day from 11 until 6. And keep in mind, I think that might be a rain or shine thing. So if it's raining tomorrow, we're going to have a lot more of Donald and be listening. Right. There's an email address for askdonald@brickyard.com tomorrow to send in your questions. And then a live call-in show tomorrow night from 7 until 8.
I think it's the Preakness.
That's
right. And then we come back from the Preakness, and then we'll do 7 to 8.
So there is racing, just a different type of racing after the end of day one of qualifying. And then Donald is back at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. And then we're back on Monday night at 8. And you're also here on Sunday evening.
Yes, from 6 until 7:30.
And then Monday night, we're back in our normal format from the studio at 8 o'clock as we get set for the 500. Thank you. We will see
you
tomorrow.
Thank you, everybody, for calling in.
Thanks for joining us tonight on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.